Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the one, the only Sean Sports Thought Podcast. That is right. This is an episode number 433. Wherever you may be, however you may be listening, I greatly appreciate it. I'm not going to waste any time. I'm not going to say wasted 20 seconds, but we're already 20 seconds in and there's no sports talk. So what's going on? There's plenty to talk about. The NBA trade deadline has officially came and went. The Super Bowl is only 3 days away. MLB free agency is still in full swing. Guys like Blake Snell and Cody Bellinger, Matt Chapman remain unsigned for the time being. And with that said, without wasting any more precious time, because as you guys know, the one thing you cannot buy with money is time. But I'm not a philosopher, I'm a podcaster. Let's get into it. The Chicago Bulls will be without Zach LaVine for the remainder of the season. The team announced that LaVine is set to undergo surgery on his right foot, and then he will be out 4 to 6 months. He is set to have surgery next week. He last played January 18th, and he's played in only 25 games in 2023-24. In those games, he's been good, though, averaging 19.5 points, over 5 rebounds, and 4 assists a game. In case you don't follow the NBA, and if you do follow the NBA but happen to live under a rock, Zach LaVine has been the subject of trade talks throughout the season, but the surgery likely derails any possibility of trading him before the offseason. He is under contract through 2025-26 with a player option for 2026-27, and he has an average salary of $43 million, which is a hurdle for sure to make a trade happen. But again, he is a productive player. He's averaged more than 20 points in the 5 preceding seasons to this one, but adding a contract of that size was seemingly a hang-up, you know, for prospective teams, potential trade destinations. That contract also doesn't fit well with this iteration of the Bulls, as the franchise is hovering in the middle of the Eastern Conference. You know, they're currently 23-26, ninth place in the East, so I'm sure that they're not really sure what to do with Zach LaVine, especially with the injury, because before he got injured, I'm sure, you know, they wanted to trade him, whether it would be before the trade deadline, which again passed as of 59 minutes ago, or in the offseason. So with that said, let's transition to the NFL. Patrick Mahomes' family, it's never dull. Never a dull moment with the Mahomes family. And it's seemingly always everybody other than the head honcho, Patrick Mahomes. This time, when it's not his wife, Brittany, getting into controversy with fans or whoever else, it's his brother, Jackson, who will never convince me that he's not a homosexual, that he's not gay, doing all kinds of weird shit and TikTok dances and everything. And now it's his father, Pat Mahomes, the father of Kansas City Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes. Patrick Mahomes Sr. was reportedly arrested Saturday on suspicion of driving while intoxicated, according to the Kansas City Star, which would be his third such offense. Wow. He was charged with his second DWI offense in 2018, pleaded guilty, serving 40 days in a county jail. He also faced DUI charges all the way back in 1994 after getting into a one-car accident and was arrested and charged with public intoxication during a 2016 matchup between TCU and Texas Tech, which, if you don't know, is his son's, Patrick Mahomes' alma mater, Texas Tech, that is. The arrest comes just a week before Mahomes and the Chiefs are set to face the San Francisco 49ers at Super Bowl 58 in Las Vegas. Mahomes Sr. told CNN on a Thursday that he was planning to be in attendance. Not sure why he was speaking to CNN in the first place, but that's besides the point. It's Patrick Mahomes' chance to earn his third ring in only his seventh season. To compete at the highest level is something that is rare and very special, Mahomes Sr. said. For him to have the amount of success that he's had this early on in his career is just surreal. It's kind of crazy, he continued. I really haven't ever seen anything like him. I've been around a lot of great athletes and Alex Rodriguez and Ricky Henderson and all these guys. But to be at the top of your game so quickly and continue to repeat it year after year, it just makes it that much more special. That would put Mahomes on pace to at least get close to Tom Brady's record-setting 7 rings or 7 Super Bowls championships. Though Mahomes Sr. wasn't ready to put his son in the GOAT conversation just yet, saying that's still to be determined. He still has a ways to go. I have mad respect for Tom Brady, and I grew up as a Joe Montana fan. Patrick is on the right trajectory, but right now I would still say those guys are better. So, Pat Mahomes, you know, I am somewhat of a reckless driver on paper, according to the law. I consider myself to be an exceptional driver. But to the average person, the way I drive would be considered stupid, dangerous, reckless, fill in the blank, whatever. But the one thing that I will never understand is drinking and driving. It makes absolutely no sense to me. There are no excuses anymore. Uber is a thing, Lyft is a thing, friends, bus, walking, crawling, what have you. Why drink and then drive? It is dangerous. It is stupid. It is retarded. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me. And what makes even less sense to me is these repeat offenders like Pat Mahomes Sr. Because I have a friend, a family friend as well, who's gotten 5 DUIs. 5 DUIs. I mean, that is something that I will never understand. I will never comprehend it. It doesn't make sense to me whatsoever. So Pat Mahomes, I mean, hopefully he doesn't get a 4th DUI. I mean, what could I say? Fuck. Let's transition to some baseball. The drama surrounding the Oakland Athletics' new stadium in Las Vegas is far from over. The Athletic reported Monday a political action committee representing a teachers' union in Nevada has filed suit challenging the legislation that paved the way for the venue's funding. Last June, Nevada Governor Joe Lombardo signed a bill that embarked $380 million in public funds toward the A Stadium, which has a total price of $1.5 billion. While that didn't represent a final step in securing the Athletics' future in Las Vegas, it was seemingly one of the biggest steps remaining. Then came the approval of the franchise's relocation by MLB owners in mid-November. But the plan has faced opposition from Nevada teachers since the fall. It was reported that the Nevada State Education Association is now arguing the legislation, SB1, violates the state constitution because it didn't set the threshold for approval at 2/3 of the Nevada Assembly and Senate majorities. Chris Daly, Deputy Executive Director for Government Relations for the NSEA, said the group is doing everything we can to make the road harder for the A's and principal owner John Fisher. Because our ultimate goal is to fund Nevada schools, and we think SB1 and the stadium deal goes in the wrong direction. Now, I can respect that. I really could. Schools over stadiums, another political action committee working on behalf of Nevada teachers, has attempted to propose a ballot initiative that would leave the issue up to voters. I'm not sure if that's a good idea for the schools over stadiums, if it was up to the voters. A judge ruled against the proposal in November, though the initiative remains a possibility if the group can gain the requisite signatures. Under their current plans, the A's are hopeful of having a new stadium built ahead of the 2028 season. It will be built on the site of the Tropicana Las Vegas, which will close its doors in April ahead of being demolished. So, yeah, I mean, this whole thing is a shit show. Like, John Fisher is a scumbag. I feel so sorry and I feel so bad for the city of Oakland, the people of Oakland, fans of the Oakland A's. They really do deserve better, especially after losing the Oakland Raiders also to Las Vegas. And even though the Golden State Warriors didn't move far away, they lost the Golden State Warriors as well because they moved from Oakland to San Francisco. So I really do feel bad for the people of Oakland. Absolutely. With that said, we are going to talk a little bit about the Super Bowl. And man, the 49ers just love to bitch and moan, don't they? The San Francisco 49ers are going to make do with the practice field at UNLV as they make their final preparations for Super Bowl 58 this weekend. Head coach Kyle Shanahan addressed the rumors about the field surface during his press conference at Super Bowl opening night on Monday. "It is what it is," he said. "We'll be all right. It's the field we got. We're good." Jonathan Jones of CBS Sports reported some 49ers staffers were, quote, "not pleased with the practice field at UNLV that the NFL set up for them to use this week." A 49ers advanced group that includes members of the equipment staff and grounds team traveled to Las Vegas last week to check out the facilities. They feel the grass is too soft for the team to practice on, and the team has considered alternative, sources say. The fields at UNLV use artificial turf, but the NFL put a grass overlay on them for the 49ers to use. So what are they even bitching about, man? Adam Schefter of ESPN reported that the sod was installed last week, with the league typically requiring practice fields for the Super Bowl to meet certain standards in December, and that the NFL hardness score for fields averages 78, with no field score being less than 70. Schefter noted the 49ers field had a hardness score somewhere in the 50s. Okay, that is pretty crazy. I take back what I was just saying. The fact that no NFL field is less than 70 and the 49ers practice field for the Super Bowl in Las Vegas is in the 50s is absolutely unbelievable, to be honest. Despite the fact that I don't really know the importance of, you know, the hardness of a football field. I mean, the only assumption I can make logically is the prevention of injuries. So despite reports of some members of the Niners organization being unhappy, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell said the field was unanimously approved by 23 different experts. Where do you find 23 different experts to judge the hardness of a football field, of the grass on a football field? That's pretty funny. The 49ers went through a walkthrough on Monday. They're scheduled to go through a full practice session on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. The Kansas City Chiefs are practicing at the Las Vegas Raiders indoor facility this week. Nick Bosa told reporters the surface was a little soft and feels a little weird when the grass on top with the grass on top of the turf. Shanahan said one reason the 49ers are going to practice at UNLV is he doesn't want to disrupt a schedule this week. The NFC champs used the bye week to install their game plan for the Super Bowl. This week's practice schedule will be about fine-tuning it. The 49ers and Chiefs will play Super Bowl 58 at Allegiant Stadium on Sunday at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 3:30 p.m. Pacific. We got some LA sports to talk about today. Today will be, I'm sure, it's a very big day. And I'm sure it will be a very emotional day. The Los Angeles Lakers announced Tuesday that they will wear their Black Mamba uniforms during Thursday's home game against the Denver Nuggets in celebration of Kobe Bryant. In a press release posted by Dan Wolk of the Los Angeles Times on X, formerly known as Twitter, the Lakers declared that they will wear the Black Mamba uniforms after unveiling a statue of Kobe Bryant outside Crypto.com Arena prior to the game. Kobe, who tragically died in a helicopter crash in 2020 at the age of only 41 years old, helped design the Black Mamba uniforms, which were first worn during the 2017-18 season. By virtue of spending his entire 20-year NBA career with the Lakers and earning 18 All-Star selections along the way, winning 5 NBA championships, NBA Finals MVP twice, NBA MVP once, he is arguably the greatest Laker of all time. And, there have been a lot of great Lakers, starting from Jerry West, Will Chamberlain, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Magic Johnson, Kobe Bryant. He was a two-time NBA scoring champion, averaging 25 points a game in 1,346 career regular season contests, and he ranks fourth on the NBA's all-time scoring list with 33,643 points. The Lakers noted that Bryant will be the seventh person in franchise history to be immortalized in the form of a statue, joining Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Elgin Baylor, Magic Johnson, Jerry West, Chick Hearn, and Shaquille O'Neal. While the Lakers typically wear purple and gold, the Black Mamba jerseys have a special place in team history, not only because of their link to Kobe Bryant, the Black Mamba himself, but also because the Lakers wore them during the playoffs in the 2020 bubble, en route to their most recent NBA championship. On Thursday, the Lakers will clash with the Denver Nuggets, the team that it is actually a rematch of the 2023 Western Conference Finals that the Denver Nuggets swept, in four games. But it was one of those series where, despite the fact that it was a sweep, every game was so close that it just as easily could have potentially been a sweep for the Lakers. So conference finals rematch, and also let's just say that Kobe has some history in the state of Colorado. So yeah, it is very ironic to say the least that the Nuggets are, the Lakers' opponents on the night of them not only wearing the Black Mamba jerseys, but also unveiling a statue of Kobe Bryant that will forever be outside Crypto.com Arena. Although LeBron James, Anthony Davis, and the Lakers are 28 and 25 this season, they are set, not necessarily world beaters so far. They are entering Thursday's game on a hot streak, having won four in a row, so there is that. Let's now transition back to some baseball. We got a couple baseball stories, a couple franchise legends in their own right, staying with the only teams that they've called home. It's unclear when Clayton Kershaw will be able to pitch in 2024, but he will be pitching for the Los Angeles Dodgers. As a Dodger fan, I couldn't be more relieved of this news. ESPN reported the three-time National League Cy Young Award winner has agreed to a deal that will keep him in Dodger blue for a 17th season. His new contract includes a player option for 2025 that could ultimately allow him to pitch alongside Shohei Ohtani. John Heyman and Joel Sherman of the New York Post were the first to report that there was a growing belief that Kershaw would sign with the Dodgers. Kershaw announced on November 3rd that he underwent shoulder surgery and was hopeful to return to play at some point in the summer. While there hasn't been a specific timeline given for Kershaw's return to pitching, it was noted that it will not happen until the second half of the season at the earliest. Dodgers President of Baseball Operations Andrew Friedman has said throughout the offseason the team would like to keep Kershaw if it's what his family want, saying, quote, "We are very respectful of Clayton and Ellen's decision and giving them the time and space to make the best decision for their family," Friedman told reporters in November at the general manager meetings, "but selfishly we hope is to continue and finish his career in Dodger blue." Kershaw has been playing on one-year deals each of the past two seasons. He has spent his entire career with the Dodgers organization since being selected with the number 7 overall pick in the 2006 MLB draft. The only other team that has ever been mentioned as a potential suitor for Kershaw or threat to sign him away from LA was the Texas Rangers because he is from Texas. Ken Rosenthal of The Athletic reported in December the Rangers were very much in play for Kershaw. The reigning World Series champions have a huge hole in their rotation right now with Jordan Montgomery, one of their best pitchers last season, you know, especially in the playoffs and in their World Series run, is a free agent. Montgomery reportedly prefers to remain with Texas, but there are no guarantees until a deal is signed. He's been connected to the New York Yankees, who ironically traded him away because they didn't view him as playoff material to the St. Louis Cardinals, who then traded him to the Rangers before last year's playoff run. And now with the Yankees trading for Juan Soto and signing Marcus Stroman, maybe they're not as interested in Monty. Even though the Rangers just won the World Series, it's hard not to see the Dodgers as Kershaw's best chance to get a World Series title in 2024. They added Shohei Ohtani, Yoshinobu Yamamoto, Tyler Glasnow, and Teoscar Hernandez to a loaded roster that already won 100 games last season. Despite dealing with injuries that limited him to only 24 starts in 2023, Kershaw was still very effective in year 16, posting a 2.46 ERA and 137 strikeouts in 131.2 innings. He posted a sub-3 ERA in three of his past four seasons. So Kershaw is back with the Dodgers. And Jose Altuve is back with the Houston Astros, signing a five-year, $125 million extension. I think that is a massive bargain for the Astros. You know, an average of only $25 million a year for a player like Jose Altuve. As much as I despise the Houston Astros organization and Jose Altuve with every fiber of my being, he is still an unbelievably great and talented baseball player. So over the 5 years, he will be making $30 million, $30 million, $30 million, $25 million, and then only $10 million in his fifth year of the contract. So that surely will be huge for the Astros at the, you know, when the time comes. The 33-year-old is coming off another productive season, though one in which he was limited to only 90 games, thanks in large part to a thumb fracture that he suffered during the World Baseball Classic. When healthy, he hit 17 homers, and he had a .311 batting average, .393 on base percentage, and .522 slugging. Among second basemen with at least 400 plate appearances, Altuve was second in WOBA at .393 and WRC plus of 154 per Fangraphs. His impending free agency raised obvious questions over his long-term future in Houston. The Astros have been one of the most consistent performers in the MLB since winning the 2017 World Series. I should say that they cheated to win that World Series, but that success hasn't been built on maintaining a high payroll. Per COD's baseball contracts, their payroll has ranked in the top five on opening day just twice since that time. Ownership in the front office haven't been afraid to watch key players leave either. I mean, Gerrit Cole, George Springer, Carlos Correa, and Justin Verlander have all walked as free agents. Cole to the Yankees, Springer to the Blue Jays, Correa to the Twins, and Verlander to the Mets, who has since actually been traded back to the Astros because of how much of a dumpster fire the Mets organization is. Tuesday's announcement perhaps speaks to the shift that has taken place after James Click's oust as a GM and Dana Brown's arrival as his replacement. Brown represented a marked contrast from how Houston's front office previously operated. The Josh Hader signing is an example of how that has translated in terms of personnel. The five-year, $95 million contract offered to the five-time All-Star, who is a closer and a relief pitcher, is pretty crazy. Jose Abreu's three-year deal worth $58.5 million and the $34 million over 3 years handed to Rafael Montero probably fall into that category as well. Both predated Brown's arrival but came after Click was shown the door after the 2022 season. So I think this is a great move for everyone involved. I mean, Altuve is already a multi-millionaire, so he didn't necessarily need to, break the bank on this contract. Let's see, what do we have next? Let's talk about some NHL hockey. An obligatory fuck the Edmonton Oilers before we talk about them. The Edmonton Oilers fell one victory short of tying the NHL's all-time win streak record on Tuesday evening, falling 3-1 to the defending Stanley Cup champion Vegas Golden Knights in Vegas. Edmonton entered Tuesday with 16 straight wins, only one win shy of tying the 1992-93 Pittsburgh Penguins' streak of 17 in a row. The Oilers got off to a great start after Connor McDavid scored a shorthanded goal on a 2-on-0 breakaway with Leon Draisaitl to put the Oilers up 1-0 4.5 minutes into the game. Vegas got one back, however, after Nicholas Roy scored off a rebound with about 2 minutes left in the first period. Neither team scored in the second period, but Vegas went up for good in the third after Chandler Stephenson put home a one-timer. William Karlsson's empty net goal sealed the win for the Golden Knights. It's a tough loss for Edmonton, who was only one win shy of tying the record, but the Oilers' win streak was an incredible run amid a very tumultuous season. They fired their head coach, Jay Woodcroft, after a horrible 3-9-1 start, replacing him with Chris Knobloch. After two wins in the new era, Edmonton lost three straight, giving up 17 goals in the process. Then they rolled off eight straight wins, but their defense then struggled once again, allowing 15 goals in three consecutive losses. But then they caught fire, legitimately, with 16 straight wins. All but one of the wins came in regulation or overtime. They've allowed no more than two goals in the final 14 wins as well. So, you know, losing to the defending Stanley Cup champions, as much as I hate the Oilers, you know, it's not the end of their season, and they're a very, very dangerous and very talented team, as much as I despise them. Let's switch gears back to the NFL. The Dallas Cowboys are reportedly interviewing former New York Jets and Buffalo Bills head coach Rex Ryan for their defensive coordinator vacancy. Josina Anderson of CBS Sports reported Ryan has joined a growing list of candidates to potentially replace Dan Quinn, who left to take the head coaching position with the Washington Commanders. Ryan has not coached in the NFL since the 2016 season, so it's been almost a decade. He spent the last 7 years working as an analyst for ESPN. The 61-year-old has not been a defensive coordinator since his run from 2005 to 2008 with the Baltimore Ravens. The Denver Broncos interviewed Ryan for their defensive coordinator opening under Sean Payton last year, but ultimately hired Vance Joseph. The Cowboys have targeted defensive coordinators with head coaching experience in their pursuit of a replacement for Quinn. Ryan joins a list that includes Ron Rivera and Mike Zimmer, who have also spent extensive time as head coaches. Cowboys defensive line coach Aiden Durd is the lone candidate who has never been a head coach. So we will see who will be the next defensive coordinator of the Dallas Cowboys, because after their performance against the Packers, we definitely know that they need it. Speaking of football, Nick Saban is wasting no time. Nick Saban's third act in his football career will be with ESPN. The company announced on Wednesday that the legendary head coach will be joining College Game Day as an analyst, a huge addition for the show given his wealth of football knowledge. Quote, ESPN and College Game Day have played such an important role in the growth of college football, and I'm honored to have the opportunity to join their team, he said in a statement. I'll do my best to offer additional insights and perspectives to contribute to College Game Day, the ultimate Saturday tradition for college football fans. Nick Saban is a singular, iconic presence in college football, ESPN chairman Jimmy Pitaro added. He is also an extremely gifted communicator who will immediately add even more credibility, authority, and entertainment value to ESPN, including our esteemed College Game Day show. So he's going to work primarily, but he will also appear on the NFL Draft and SEC Media Days coverage as well. His first act saw him climb through the college ranks with head coaching stints at Toledo, Michigan State, and LSU, while also holding down a defensive coordinator position with the Cleveland Browns from 1991 to 94. He won a national championship at LSU and the NFL came calling, leading to the Miami Dolphins hiring him in 2005. That ended poorly, however, as Saban went 15-17 in two seasons with the Dolphins in 2005-06. But Alabama was very happy to bring him aboard at the beginning of his second act and his most successful. And what an act it was. He went 206-29 with the Alabama Crimson Tide and won six national championships, creating an absolute juggernaut of a school. While Georgia and Kirby Smart eventually caught up to Alabama later in Saban's tenure, I should say near the end of his tenure, the school's run of dominance in both the loaded SEC and across the college football landscape in general was truly incredible to witness. He retired from the sport this offseason as arguably the greatest college football head coach of all time. I don't think there's any doubt about that. As for his third act, it had long been rumored that he was ESPN's dream hire for College Game Day, giving them a fantastic eventual replacement for Lee Corso. His insights should be a welcome addition to the show, so that is very cool. Let us now talk about some more baseball, shall we? Baseball won't be featured at the 2024 Paris Olympics, but the sport will make its return in 2028 when the games are held in Los Angeles. With that in mind, it appears that the door is cracked open for current MLB players to participate in the games for the first time ever. Quote, some Major League Baseball owners are increasingly supportive of sending major leaguers to the 2028 Olympic Games in Los Angeles, The Athletic reported on Wednesday. The report dropped after Casey Wasserman, chairperson of the Wasserman Media Group, made a presentation to owners at the league's owners' meetings outside Orlando, Florida this week. Wasserman, who held Los Angeles' bid for the games, pitched a tournament structure that would reportedly have minimal impact on MLB's 2028 season. It isn't uncommon for a professional sports league to halt play for international competition. The NHL did so in 1998, 2002, 2006, 2010, and 2014, and they're going to return to the games in 2026 and 2030. The WNBA has sent professionals every time since 2000. I mean, no surprise there. But that has never happened with the MLB. 2028 could very well mark the first time it does happen. The 2023 World Baseball Classic brought in record television ratings and attendance, and there was a buzz surrounding the tournament. A similar showcase on an even bigger global stage can certainly be beneficial to the MLB and baseball, the growth of baseball as a whole. Of course, the biggest obstacle is the season, but it was reported that Wasserman discussed a condensed schedule that would occur over perhaps 5 or 6 days. The tournament would include 6 or 8 countries. In addition, the baseball portion of the Olympics could be scheduled around the league All-Star break, creating less disruption to the schedule. The 2028 games are set for July 14th to July 30th, and the All-Star game is always in mid-July. It was mentioned the possibility of the All-Star game being canceled for 1 year only for the Olympics. He also made clear that no decision is imminent on the matter and that a huge number of hurdles and logistics would need to be accounted for. One of the bigger hurdles is that player participation in the Olympics would need to be approved by the MLB Players Association. Speaking of the MLB Players Association, we got some more baseball to talk about. It seems like the arbitration record in the MLB gets broken every single year. Toronto Blue Jays star Vladimir Guerrero Jr. will make $19.9 million in the 2024 season after winning his arbitration case on Wednesday. The Blue Jays made an $18.05 million arbitration offer with a three-person panel of Scott Bucciet, Walt Dutrieux, and John Charles sided with Vladdy Jr.'s request. It's the highest salary arbitration ever awarded in the history of the MLB. Vladdy's still only 24 years old. He quickly emerged as one of baseball's most feared sluggers, hitting .264 with 26 homers, 94 RBIs, 76 runs scored, and a .788 OPS in 2023. But the crazy thing about those numbers is that by his own lofty standards, it was much of a down year. You know, in 2022, he hit 48 home runs, an incredible 1.002 OPS in 2021 with 32 homers in 2021 and an .818 OPS in 2022. He's now a three-time All-Star, and he was the American League MVP runner-up in the 2021 season. If not for a gentleman by the name of Shohei Ohtani, Vladdy would have certainly been the 2021 American League MVP. He also won a Gold Glove in the 2022 for his defensive work at first base. He's the defending Home Run Derby champion, and he will be the cover athlete for the video game MLB The Show 24. So yes, Vladdy has quickly emerged as a bona fide star in his five-year career thus far, and he was a worthy candidate to set a new arbitration record. That process has been good to the young slugger, who agreed to a $7.9 million figure in 2022, $14.5 million ahead of last season. He is eligible for arbitration one more time before becoming an unrestricted free agent before the 2026 season. So we will see what happens with Vladdy and the Blue Jays. Let's switch gears back to the NHL. You know, there's the Fall Classic, that's the World Series, of course. The Midsummer Classic is the All-Star Game. But veering a little bit away from baseball, there is the Winter Classic in the NHL. Wrigley Field has hosted plenty of Chicago-St. Louis rivalry matchups during baseball season between the Chicago Cubs and St. Louis Cardinals, but the Cubs and Cardinals won't be the only city rivals playing at the iconic venue in 2025. The NHL announced Wednesday the Chicago Blackhawks will host the St. Louis Blues in the 2025 NHL Winter Classic at Wrigley Field. As ESPN noted, this will be the second time the Winter Classic takes place at Wrigley Field. The first time was in 2009 between the same Chicago Blackhawks, of course, and the visiting Detroit Red Wings. This also marks another return to one of baseball's most storied venues for the Winter Classic, as the Boston Red Sox's Fenway Park hosted the event in 2010 and 2023. Chicago is no stranger to the national spotlight of outdoor games. The 2025 will be its fourth Winter Classic and seventh time participating in an outdoor game, which is more than any other NHL team. That the Blackhawks were chosen yet again comes as no surprise given their history and the presence of 2023 number one overall pick Connor Bedard, who is expected to be he is the face of the franchise. St. Louis last played in the Winter Classic in 2022 against the Minnesota Wild at Target Field. Quote, "My last outdoor game memory was playing outdoor hockey when I was a kid, so it's an exciting opportunity," Blackhawks coach Luke Richardson said, per the Chicago Sun-Times. Despite playing a number of outdoor games, the Blackhawks haven't enjoyed much success. Their only win out of seven outdoor games came against the Pittsburgh Penguins at Soldier Field in 2014. They lost to the Blues when they faced each other in St. Louis's Busch Stadium in 2017, and most recently lost to the Boston Bruins in 2019 at Notre Dame Stadium. Another loss wouldn't be shocking at all, especially since Chicago is so bad this year, last in the Central Division with a record of 14-34-2 for only 30 points. St. Louis, by comparison, isn't great either, but they're somewhat decent at 26-21-2 for 54 points. Let's talk about the NBA trade deadline now, shall we? Let's do it. The Indiana Pacers have traded shooting guard Buddy Hield to the Philadelphia 76ers ahead of Thursday's deadline. The Pacers will receive Marcus Morris, Furkan Korkmaz, and 3 second-round picks in return. This is the second time the 31-year-old has been traded in the last 3 years. The Pacers acquired him in February 2022 as part of a trade with the Sacramento Kings that involved 6 players. He's in the last year of his contract, and he's making $19.2 million for this season. Last spring, Pacers president of basketball operations, Kevin Pritchard, said the team was not opposed to signing him to an extension. However, The Athletic reported on September 20th that talks for a potential extension had stalled on both sides, and they were working together to find a trade for the veteran. Hield said during Media Day on October 2nd that he was open to remaining with the Pacers, but obviously that ultimately didn't happen. NBA insider Mark Stein reported on January 14th that the Pacers have been building trade offers around the package of Hield and a first-round pick. Hield's production has dipped this season as he's been deployed in a hybrid bench role for the Pacers. In 52 games, 28 of which have been starts, he's averaged 12 points a game, the second lowest average of his career. His average of only 25.7 minutes is also the lowest since 2017-18. So, Buddy Hield to the Sixers. Another trade. The Dallas Mavericks get some reinforcements. PJ Washington is headed to Dallas. The Mavericks are acquiring Washington and 2 second-round picks from the Charlotte Hornets in exchange for Grant Williams, Seth Curry, and a first-round pick, according to The Athletic. The selection Charlotte will receive is a lightly protected 2027 first-round pick, according to Woj of ESPN. Washington brings him a much stronger offensive game than that of Williams. The 25-year-old is averaging 14 points, 5 rebounds, and 2 assists in 44 games, while shooting 45% from the floor and 32% from 3. His numbers are down from last season, but that's likely a result of being on the worst teams, one of the worst teams in the NBA. PJ Washington figures to slot in into the starting five alongside Luka Doncic, Kyrie Irving, and Derek Lively II. However, it's not clear how this move alone will vault the Mavs into potential title contention. Let's talk about the Knicks. They made a big trade. I mean, people might not realize how big of a trade this is. The Knicks are going through quite the roster overhaul ahead of the deadline. They acquired Bojan Bogdanovic and Alec Burks from The New York Knicks have acquired Bojan Bogdanovic and Alec Burks from the Detroit Pistons in exchange for Quentin Grimes, Evan Fournier, Malachi Flynn, Ryan Archie Diacono, and 2 future second-round picks. The Knicks have been linked to a move for Burks over the last several weeks. Hoops Hype reported last month that the Knicks were doing their due diligence and looking at various players across the league, including Hornets guard Terry Rozier, Blazers guard Malcolm Brogdon, and former Tom Thibodeau favorite Alec Burks. ESPN's Bobby Marks also linked the Knicks to Bogdanovic last month during an appearance on the Hoops Hype podcast. Burks spent the 2020-21 and 2021-22 seasons with the Knicks before being traded to the Pistons ahead of the 2022-23 season. The 32-year-old was a key member of Thibodeau's rotation during his tenure with the franchise, averaging over 12 points, 5 rebounds, and 3 assists in 130 games across 2 seasons, while shooting 40% from the floor and 41% from 3. That might be the first time I've ever seen someone shoot better from 3 than from the field overall. Pretty crazy. But Bogdanovic is now on the Knicks. That's pretty awesome, if you ask me. More trades. Patrick Beverley is on the move for the fourth time. For the fourth time in the last 2 seasons. The Philadelphia 76ers are trading Pat Bev to the Milwaukee Bucks in exchange for Cameron Payne and a second-round pick. The second-round pick comes in 2027 per Woj of ESPN. Beverley had been an effective member of the Sixers rotation in his first season with the franchise. Through 47 games, the 3-time all-defensive player was averaging 6 points, 3 rebounds, and 3 assists while shooting 43% from the floor and 32% from 3. Beverley will be a much more valuable asset for the Bucks given his ability to defend, so This is almost like the Milwaukee Bucks are trying to replace Drew Holiday's defensive skill with that of Patrick Beverley, obviously with Drew Holiday signing with the Boston Celtics. While the Bucks sit third in the Eastern Conference at 33-18, thanks in large part to Giannis Antetokounmpo and Damian Lillard, they boast one of the worst defenses in the NBA, and they were in desperate need of some help on that end of the floor. Milwaukee ranks 18th in the league in defensive rating at 116.3 after parting ways with Adrian Griffin and hiring Doc Rivers as head coach, but they're only 1-4 since Rivers took over. So let's see. Let us now talk about some NBA trade deadline. I'm going to give some grades on these trades, give my thoughts on them. First up, Doug McDermott to the Indiana Pacers. So Doug McDermott to the Pacers for Marcus Morris Sr., second-round pick in cash. Let's be clear about one thing. McDermott does not replace Buddy Hield's functional gravity. He does, however, remain a malleable offensive weapon. I'm kind of shocked he's still in the NBA, honestly. McDermott will supplement some of the outside efficiency and volume forfeited with Hield's departure, depending on how much he plays. The 32-year-old is canning 43.5% of his spot-up triples. Pretty automatic, honestly. So I would give the Pacers an A for this. Congratulations to the Spurs on finally getting Morris. Their union will be short-lived. San Antonio plans to buy him out. This is mostly, you know, this is another move for the Spurs. I'll give them an A because why not? Pat Bev to the Bucks, just talked about it. I'll give the Bucks a B. You know, Pat Bev is great defense for them. I'll give the Sixers a B plus. Losing Beverly is an emotional, you know, as an emotional kind of glue guy, might sting a little bit. But the Sixers are far from getting hosed here. In fact, it might be the opposite. What Payne lacks in defensive hustle and strength, he offsets with additional layers of offensive creation. He's shooting 53.3% on floaters and almost 40% from three, including 43.6% on pull-up triples. So I think it's a win-win trade for both teams. Royce O'Neal to the Suns. So the Nets got Keita, Bates, Diop, Jordan Goodwin, and 3 second-round picks. Grizzlies got Chimezie Metu, Yuta Watanabe, and a pick swap. And the Suns got Royce O'Neal and David Roddy. Give the Nets a B+. It's pretty good value for O'Neal when you consider he's on an expiring contract and shouldn't be tussling with cream-of-the-crop point-of-attack creators anymore. Each exact second-round pick details aren't available just yet, but I think it's a solid trade for the Nets. As for the Grizzlies, it's TBD. Trading D'Anthony Melton for Roddy already isn't looking so hot. It looks even worse now. Perhaps that changes once we know which pick swap Memphis is getting from Phoenix, but I doubt it. Reuniting with Watanabe is a semi-interesting development, provided that he finally uncorks more threes. Then again, even if he does, the Grizzlies won't have the bird rights to keep him should he play well enough to decline his player option. So, yeah, I'll give the Grizzlies a TBD on this one, to be determined. The Suns knocked it out of the park. They get an A+. Snagging Royce O'Neal for second-round picks and minimum contracts without including one of your two best salary-matching assets, being Grayson Allen or Nasir Little, is a huge home run for the Phoenix Suns. O'Neal is a notch or two slower than he used to be and shouldn't be guarding elite players at the point of attack. But he's still solid. I mean, I think it's, you know, PJ Washington is to the Mavs. So the Hornets got Seth Curry, Grant Williams, and a 2027 first-round pick. The Hornets nailed it with this trade. They are getting excellent value for PJ Washington, specifically amid an uneven season in which his outside efficiency has dipped, but he's made the most of his paint touches. That Dallas selection is barely protected and post-dates the contracts of both Luka Doncic, who has a 2026-27 player option, and Kyrie Irving. Grabbing a look-see at Grant Williams as well counts as something, too. He never quite found his footing on the Mavs, but he's a stretchy forward who can switch and play next to Mark Williams on the front line. Will Williams take enough threes, complain less, grab a defensive rebound? All fair questions, but he's still only 25 years old, and the final 3 years and $40.9 million on his contract aren't backbreaking, even if they might seem dicey. As for the Mavs, I'll give them a D+, and I'll be generous with that. Make no mistake, Washington is an upper echelon fit in Dallas. He has some downhill and interior craftiness to his game, and he will knock down a higher percentage of his threes while fielding passes from Luka and Kyrie. But, there is a huge but. Dating back to the sign-and-trade transaction that landed them Williams this past offseason, the Mavs have now turned a 2027 first-rounder and an unprotected 2030 first-round swap into PJ Washington. That is underwhelming. Spencer Dinwiddie to the Raptors. So the Nets got Dennis Schroeder and Thaddeus Young. The Raptors got Dinwiddie. I'll give the Nets a B. You know, why not? On the bright side, it doesn't look like the Nets included Dennis Smith Jr. in this deal, for now anyway. And Schroeder, unlike Dinwiddie, is on the books for next season at roughly mid-level exception money. That's a good stopgap to have for a Brooklyn offense thin on self-creators and facilitators. Schroeder is also having a better season from deep than Dinwiddie and remains both a higher volume and efficiency player at the rim. So while this is not a game-changer deal necessarily, it's a solid move for the Nets. For the Raptors, it's good for them too, a B+. They are prioritizing flexibility above all else with this swap. The best version of Dinwiddie is better than Schroeder as a perimeter creator, but the Raptors won't be in the business of finding out. They plan to wave Dinwiddie. I would love the Lakers to pick him up.
Offloading the $13 million that Schroeder is owed next season is the bigger deal. Toronto now has the bandwidth to carry Emmanuel Quickley's restricted free agency hold and chisel out more than $40 million in cap space, so I think this is another win-win trade, surprisingly. Daniel Gafford to the Mavs. So the Mavs got a 2024 first-round pick, which is second least favorable from Houston, the LA Clippers, OKC, and Utah. The Thunder got a 2028 first-round pick swap. The Mavs also got Daniel Gafford, and the Wizards got Richaun Holmes. Draft compensation, a 2024 first-round pick, which, again, is second least favorable from Houston, the Clippers, OKC, and Utah. I'll give the Mavs, they did much better on this one. Still could have been better, but I'll give them a B-. Bringing in Gafford makes a ton of sense for the Mavs. Their reserve big rinks are very, very thin. And Derek Lively II's nasal fracture has only hollowed out the front court even further. So, great move for them. Thunder, they hit a home run. When it comes to trades, the Oklahoma City Thunder are elite. Giving up a tangible first-round pick for a swap that you may or may not exercise is taboo for most teams, but the Thunder have officially reached the point at which their imminent inbound first-rounders exceed their roster space, which is insane. Flipping a first-rounder that could convey in the bottom five of a weak draft for a bite at the Mavs' future beyond Luka's current deal is a very shrewd swing. And I'll give the Wizards an A-. The spirit of this trade makes sense for the Wizards. They should be prioritizing draft compensation, even when it comes to, you know, even when it comes attached to undesirable money, like Holmes' 2024-25 player option, but, you know, whatever. Bogdanović and Burks to the Knicks. So, I just talked about this one. So, I would give the Pistons a B-plus for this one. Getting the final deals of this trade was a journey, but finally here, Pistons finally traded Bogdanović. Detroit's deadline is currently all over the place, but the addition of Simone Fontecchio makes for more sense following the deal. Fournier has a team option for next season, which the Pistons will almost assuredly decline. That means they essentially flipped Bogdanovich's $20 million salary slot for some prospects with a year left. You know, not much, which is what they want. This is rock-solid business that has the potential to mushroom into something more. Grimes has struggled to sustain three-point volume and attack in space aggression. He's also flashed plenty of both. So I think it's a great trade for the Pistons, and I think it's an even better one for the Knicks. Jettisoning Emmanuel Quickley and RJ Barrett for OG Anunoby created a ball-handling void on the Knicks roster. Julius Randle's dislocated right shoulder then left the rotation light on even more shot creation on top of shot making. They have now filled basically every one of those gaps. Burks is not an A-plus passer, but the Knicks have plenty of ball movers to offset the facilitation drop-off when Jalen Brunson catches a breather, mainly Josh Hart, Dante DiVincenzo, and Deuce McBride. Burks is most critical for his reliable self-starting. He has some wiggle when he gets into the lane, and he's drilling over 38% of his pull-up triples this season. Bogdanović, honestly, is a monster acquisition for the Knicks. He is one of the most dangerous perimeter shooters in the world. That is not hyperbole. His 41.5% clip from three comes on more than 8 attempts per 36 minutes. He's downing nearly 50% of his shots off drives, and he'll bust out the on-ball chops every now and then and jumpstart his own offense. Bogdanović should fit like a glove on the Knicks, both with and without Julius Randle. Head coach Tom Thibodeau can stagger the two, but New York has the personnel to play Bogdanović, Randle, and a big together. You're welcome, says Anunoby. And to top it all off, the Knicks are far enough beneath the luxury tax to make a buyout splash if the opportunity presents itself, which I'm sure it will. One small concern here for the Knicks. They are rolling over Fournier's salary slot into a much better player, but also an older one. Bogdanović turns 35 in April, and though guaranteeing his $19 million salary for next season will arm New York with a valuable anchor in prospective trades, this team likely won't treat him as an inbound asset. Perhaps I'm nitpicking, but, you know. Next up, Kelly Olynyk to the Raptors. So the Raptors got Ochai Agbaji and Kelly Olynyk for Kyra Lewis Jr., Otto Porter Jr., a 2024 first-round pick, which will be least favorable from the Rockets, Clippers, Thunder, and Jazz. B-plus for the Raptors. Most won't love the not-very-good Raptors forking over a first-round pick. Get over it. That selection is slated to convey in the bottom five, and nobody seems to love this draft class. Toronto also currently has Indiana's first-rounder as well as the number 31 pick anyway. Both Agbaji and Olynyk feel needs as well. Agbaji is having a sophomore season to forget, but he's provided glimpses into functional spacing and finishing and try-hard defense. Olynyk is having a terrific season in which he's stretching defenses and most impressively facilitating the offense from live dribbles and standstills. For the Jazz, it's not really a good trade. It says a lot about the Jazz's view of Agbaji that this is the return they accepted, while also sending out one of their most immediately valuable players. Team CEO Danny Ainge and GM Justin Zanig deserve credit for pulling the ripcord when other organizations might have tried to force fit in development that never materialized, but doesn't make much sense. Gordon Hayward to the Oklahoma City Thunder. The Hornets got Davis Bertans, Trey Mann, Vasilije Micic, and draft compensation. The Thunder got Gordon Hayward. Another great trade for the Hornets. Loving this deal for the Hornets. I just love it. Hayward is 33 years old. He's headed into free agency, and he's injury prone. There's no other way to describe it. He did not factor into the Hornets' future at all. This deal also shaves more than $3 million off of this year's payroll. Getting a look at Trey Mann is a solid, especially, you know, teaming up with LaMelo Ball. But I think this is an even better trade for the Thunder. I mean, Oklahoma City just bought at the deadline. You know, they're in win-now mode. They have Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Josh Giddey, Lu Dort, Jalen Williams. They're in win-now mode. It's a great move. Buddy Hield to the Sixers. A-plus for the Sixers. This is exactly what they needed. A volume three-point shooter. It's exactly what they needed. And a C-minus for the Pacers. I mean, I just don't like the return, honestly. And lastly, there's actually a lot more trades that are kind of, you know, irrelevant. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is all we have for this episode of the Sean Sports Thought Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. This was episode number 433. And with that, I'm out. Peace.